From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Some abortion rights activists in the entertainment business are calling for a boycott of production in Georgia. Last week, the governor there signed a bill banning abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. Some pro-abortion rights Georgia production workers are criticizing a possible boycott. We'll find out why right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a good start to your day. Such pleasure to have you with us. Coming up, a new plan to revamp the troubled California DMV. A recent state audit shows a host of serious problems in the Department of Motor Vehicles. Are they fixable? We'll get into that next. But first, the future of Georgia film and TV production in the wake of that state's new heartbeat abortion law. Last week, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill that aims to ban abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected. That can be as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. Abortion rights advocates are outraged over the law, including those working in the entertainment biz. A few Hollywood-based production companies have announced they won't do any projects in Georgia. They're companies that don't typically work there anyway, but the threat of a larger-scale boycott could do serious economic harm to Georgia's estimated 200,000 entertainment industry-related employees. Joining us to talk about where things stand with the Georgia film and TV business, senior film writer at Variety, Matt Donnelly. Matt, thank you for joining us. Oh, we don't have Matt. We're going to get him on momentarily. I'd like to hear from you if you work in the entertainment business. I welcome your thoughts about this, whether you think a boycott is the right approach to take with Georgia over the fetal heartbeat law or not. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. A chance for you to share your thoughts about this. Now, the companies that have weighed in with a boycott on production include companies I mentioned don't really do much production there. Mark Duplass of the Duplass Brothers Productions, David Simon of Blown Deadline, Simon's show, of course, The Wire, which was a huge HBO series for many years, Christine Vachon of Killer Films. They've called for a boycott, but a lot of the other companies that do serious business in Georgia, they haven't made any determination about whether they will continue to do business there. Matt Donnelly, as I mentioned, senior film writer at Variety. Matt, thank you for joining us. Any indication that more production companies might be looking to pull out of Georgia?
Hi, thank you. You know, I think right now a lot of the majors are watching and waiting to see if the bill effectively becomes law. But, you know, there's a ton of investment in the state in the form of huge facilities, in the form of, you know, tons of artisans and craftspeople have moved their families there for permanent residency. So I think there's a lot entailed in sort of just yanking up all that infrastructure. So, yeah, I think they're all biding their time. And a couple of people have found some sort of strategic ways to be supportive. If you look just last week, J.J. Abrams and Jordan Peele decided to donate their production fees from an HBO series they're doing called Lovecraft Country to charitable causes supporting resistance to the bill. So I think that people are sort of looking for a pivot and ways to support, but also keep that deep production infrastructure they've established there.
Well, and is there much discussion also about the fact that the bill is likely to be stayed? A number of these bills in different states will likely in some form, either in combination or individually, go to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's where it'll be decided.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of people are, especially in Hollywood, are hopeful that a higher court will decide and ultimately strike it down. Specifically, the lobbying voice for all the major studios in Washington, the MPAA, I'm told, and as Variety's reported, is sort of watching and waiting as well.
Well, and do any of these companies have concerns that they may have people who are involved in the productions who support the fetal heartbeat bill and that not everybody in Hollywood may necessarily be critical of the bill? Or is that so fringe in Hollywood that that's not really a consideration?
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I think it would be, you know, Hollywood is obviously perceived as a very liberal place, but I think it would be perceived as sort of a counterintuitive to the values of Hollywood, and especially at such a time in show business when prioritizing the voice of women and female filmmakers and female talent has become such a sort of marquee issue. I think that to support the bill would sort of stand in contrary to that. But, you know, it's something to consider, surely. I mean, there's human cost to all these sort of cultural issues that come up. But, yeah, I haven't heard anyone say or speak to support.
All right. We're talking with a Variety reporter who's been closely following this story, Matt Donnelly. Again, I'd like to hear from you what you think about the potential of a production boycott for Georgia. According to that state, 200,000 employees work in production-related businesses. Now, that might be directly for TV series or films that are being done there. But of course, as you well know, that's just a part of the jobs that the entertainment industry creates. When they're doing productions, you've got all kinds of food services, you've got construction, you've got utilities, many, many different industries that benefit as a result of production activity. And Georgia has emerged as a result of incentives as one of the centers of production in the United States. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Matt, there has been a petition that has gathered signatures in Georgia that's highly critical of those in Hollywood who were calling for a boycott. And the gist of it, as I read it, is that those employees in Georgia say, we've been working hard to try and defeat this bill. We've been strongly on record against this restriction on abortion. Now, if you come in and you know, essentially from your easy chair, say, okay, we just won't do business anymore, it's going to harm all these people who've been very politically active attempting to serve the same cause there in Georgia.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I think that that's certainly a strong arguing point from the studio perspective, that, again, they have such incredibly deep infrastructure and so many people have migrated from Los Angeles to Atlanta. There's the local economy is so huge and ripe with production now. But, you know, I guess I would argue that ultimately that is an easy chair that the people at the levers of decision sit at. But, again, it's just about production costs. You know, no one's forcing anyone to shoot anywhere. You know what I mean? Like you can easily just spend the money and go somewhere else is one argument you could make. And then I would also call into question, you know, about the effectiveness of those political groups. I would wonder if they wouldn't be better off served reallocating their resources and their attention to striking down the bill from becoming law. But yeah, there's plenty of argument on both sides.
We're talking with Matt Donnelly, senior film writer at Variety, also with us, creative director and production designer of Film Impact Georgia. It's a nonprofit that works with content creators working in the Georgia film industry. And she's one of those behind this petition, Molly Coffey. Ms. Coffey, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So if there were to be many more of these production companies who really do business in Georgia pulling out or not putting new productions into the state, what would be the impact on your colleagues in Georgia?
Well, the beautiful thing about the last year is even though we saw some losses within Georgia, we saw a lot of wins where we flipped quite a few seats in the state of Georgia. Like we, 67%.
Let me just interrupt because my question is about the economic impact those that are working in the industry, not sort of the political organizing. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, 300 new businesses expanded in Georgia since 2010 to support the industry. Those are not just people that moved to the state. These are people that lived within Georgia and met the demand and we've now seen this influx. It was $2.7 billion of direct spending in the state in 2018. We're not talking about the larger economic impact. That's direct spending that was spent in businesses in Georgia. If we pull out of Georgia, we're basically abandoning those people who invested in, who now have seen this influx of business and have moved into supporting the industry. We're abandoning them. We're leaving these people out in the cold who Georgia is their home. There's a privilege that was involved in being able to move with the incentives to Georgia and make a home here. But those people then have the privilege of moving to the next incentive state. And there's an entire economic impact that was made here that don't have that privilege.
If the boycott goes into effect and you got a lot of these companies who say, yeah, we're not going to do business in Georgia because of the heartbeat ban, do you think that that would cause the state government to withdraw the bill, or would it change anything about the practical effect of the law?
I don't think that at all. Sonny Perdue, who is our ex-governor, just stated on Fox News that he is not concerned about the film industry leaving Georgia. If we are having, and we've proven that we are, having a political influence over what's happening in Georgia, the industry leaving is a very easy option of a way to fix that.
Okay, so even with all the revenue that the production brings to the state, I mean, that was the justification for the incentives, right? Even with that, they'd be willing to forego it over this bill and the politics.
I mean, I think that they're proving that very much that that's exactly what they think. I mean, they need to regain control of Georgia, and the easiest way is just to let the film industry move on to the next incentive state.
Of the people that are working in the industry there, do you have a sense how many of them are Georgia natives versus how many worked in the industry elsewhere, like Southern California, and relocated to Georgia because of the opportunities there?
Well, it's particularly interesting to see Atlanta versus the rest of the state of Georgia in particular. You know, in Atlanta, that the people that have moved to Georgia, like, they are all centered there. But you're seeing positive economic impact in all of the counties that are outlying of Atlanta. Sonoya is a perfect example, and the influx that The Walking Dead has made to the town, in which they continually be sure to spend their money in Sonoya and then move outwards from that. So they are putting money and time into, like, revitalizing a city that was on the cusp of dying. Like, we can't focus on Atlanta as being Georgia, and you start to think that maybe when you move outside of Georgia, you're just moving into, like, lower economic and more red states, but 67% of Georgians do not support the court overturning Roe versus Wade. We just need those numbers to now be reflected in our local elections. And again, if we pull the film industry out, we take half of the blue voters interstate with us.
We're talking with Molly Coffey. She is a production designer and creative director for Film Impact Georgia, a nonprofit that works with content creators within the Georgia film industry. Molly Coffey, one of the women behind the petition that has several hundred signatures, calling on production companies to not boycott Georgia's film and television industry. The concern there, what the economic damage will be to those who work in the business. Also, the claim from those who work there that it's counterproductive to the overall political aims of those who don't want to see abortion rights restricted. The move to potentially boycott Georgia productions as a result of last week's signing by Governor Kemp of the fetal heartbeat abortion restriction. The bill, which is not immediately in effect, but it calls ultimately for a ban on abortions once the heartbeat of a fetus is detected. That could be as soon as 6 weeks after conception, which would be before, in many cases, women would know that they are pregnant and would be able to make a decision about having an abortion. Once again, if you work in the industry, I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, whether you support a boycott of Georgia production or whether you support the position of the production workers in Georgia. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Andrew in Hollywood. Welcome to AirTalk.
Thank you. I'm curious if you and your guest, Larry, ever think there will come a time when Hollywood acknowledges that we actually make all of our decisions based on money anyway, but we continue to involve ourselves in these social issues where, as you said yourself, these production companies that are boycotting don't even have productions in Georgia. And as long as Georgia continues to provide subsidies, we're going to continue to shoot there. I just don't understand why we're always making these somewhat, in some ways, empty gestures.
So do you think that given the financial implications, there's really no way a wide-scale boycott is going to take off?
I don't think so, and I don't exactly know. Maybe your guest knows exactly what the revenue is. A portion of Georgia's revenue is provided by the film industry. Is that enough to make them change their mind?
Well, she said she doesn't think so, and so she doesn't see that a boycott is going to have an effect on the actual law. But I guess, you know, Hollywood is – there's a lot of you know, follow the leader sort of behavior. So I'm just wondering the fact that you have three companies that have said they're going to boycott, even with the financial implications, if other companies are going to feel like they're going to get so much peer pressure to take part in it that they can't avoid doing it.
Yeah. Is that going to affect their bottom line, you think, from peer pressure, or is it just the viewership that's going to change?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the bottom line might well be affected if they don't take incentives out of Georgia. But Molly Coffey, you want to weigh in on this?
Well, you know, I think the issue, even like we're focusing on Georgia right now because we are an incentive state and we've taken so much of the film industry work to here. But this is a larger conversation being had about, you know, the United States and Roe versus Wade. And if, you know, we're only one of many states that this is being, you know, that this is being pushed in. Like Louisiana, which is another incentive state, will have their own bill being introduced fairly soon that is a version of the heartbeat bill. So, you know, choosing to fight this battle in Georgia is counterproductive when there are currently 20 abortion cases in the pipeline at the Supreme Court that any one of them could overturn Roe versus Wade. I think that it's very easy to boycott Georgia when people are annoyed that so much of the industry has come here, when there are people that are unemployed in Los Angeles. But I think we need to look at the larger picture of fighting this. In the state of Georgia, the best way to put your resources is towards the ACLU Georgia, who will be the ones fighting in the courts in the Supreme, like in Georgia, for this.
So it's interesting. Your thought is that there's antipathy toward flight of production to Georgia from Southern California, so that there may be people in the industry in Southern California who are angry about that to begin with, and this becomes a vehicle for that ire.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Molly, for being with us and sharing your concerns about what a wider scale boycott would mean to the many employees of production companies in Georgia. Molly Coffey of Film Impact Georgia with us. Our thanks to Matt Donnelly. Is Matt back? Oh, good. We got Matt back. Matt, I wanted, before we close this out, we had a question from Bill in the San Gabriel Valley, wondering about the boycotts of North Carolina work because of the gender bathroom bill there. Do you know whether that had any effect?
You know, I think I do remember the groundswell around that. And, you know, the truth is North Carolina's tax incentives are nowhere near the attractive 30% that you find in Georgia. But I'd have to double check and see how that legislation panned out. But Hollywood tends to get very feverish about causes like these, and then you can see it dissipate over time when people have to sort of regroup and figure out where to shoot next. You know, with the content business being what it is, which is a massive volume game right now, productions have to come together quickly. They have to come together often. So I think that really any response to a sort of like, you know, societal or moral issue like these that get put in front of us, you know, a lot of times people have to just act swiftly and make sure that content gets delivered on time. But something like Georgia, again, with a staggering 30% tax rebate, obviously there's huge financial gains and just like, you know, really smart economics to play there. So I would think no matter what, this issue would be a lot more sensitive than anything in North Carolina.
Yeah. And what's your sense of, again, we've seen very often that peer pressure in Hollywood is very powerful in that community, and that for people who are outliers, they get a lot of pressure. If you get a couple of big companies that decide they're not going to do future productions there or pull productions out, do you think that that peer pressure is going to get so strong it's going to be difficult for other companies to stay?
Yeah, you know, I think the entire ballgame is momentum. So it all depends on how outspoken and sort of how committed people are willing to surface this issue over and over again. You know, it's interesting that so far we haven't heard anything from Time's Up, which is a sort of very galvanized, female-focused activist group that, you know, seeks gender equity in, the pay scale, in obviously with harassment allegations, you know, so it depends on how many people and how often they're willing to keep the issue relevant. I'll point to something like J.J. Abrams and Jordan Peele, you know, making that donation of their fees to the cause while remaining in Atlanta is like a really sort of beautiful compromise that makes them look like they're, contributing something to the conversation, when really I think it's very clear that pulling out entirely and affecting the bottom line of the state is a message to Kemp, you know, directly, that Hollywood won't stand for something like this.
Matt, thank you so much. Really appreciate your being with us. Matt Donnelly joining us from Variety. Let me share a comment from Beth, who writes on the page, "I work in the film industry. In fact, I worked in Atlanta several months last summer. The film industry is exploding in Atlanta. One thing I learned, the local film crews aren't happy when out-of-town productions come to Atlanta and bring in out-of-state crew. They want locals hired first. This kind of a boycott might not matter because local production companies can still find local employees. I also think companies have the right to choose not to do business somewhere." That's Beth writing on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. And of course, Molly Coffey of Film Impact Georgia talking about the significant difference between productions that are headquartered in Atlanta and then those that are done outside of the capital city. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Well, most of us have DMV stories, I would assume, either long lines, confused employees, or difficult dealings with California's Department of Motor Vehicles to the point where it's a staple of jokes. But Governor Gavin Newsom's administration is attempting to deal with a couple of very high-profile breakdowns within the DMV. He's put together a strike team to try and modernize the department and respond to the withering criticism of the DMV's operation. The Sacramento Bee acquired the 110-page report that the DMV sent to lawmakers outlining recommendations from the strike team. With us, Sacramento Bee political reporter Brian Anderson to talk about what's planned for the department. Brian, good morning.
Morning, Larry. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So let's talk first of all about the serious problems that the department has had within the past year, particularly over motor voter registering people automatically who were not eligible to vote, and the tremendous lack of readiness of the department for the real IDs that people were going to need for air travel if they didn't have a passport. What at root were the problems identified with those breakdowns?
Sure. So there's two separate programs there. There's the motor voter program and the Real ID. And the motor voter program automatically registers customers at DMV offices when they visit. And one of the problems that had emerged was technological errors and people being registered with the wrong party in some cases, some non-citizens who are believed to be added to the voter rolls. We know of at least one confirmed case. And the second program that had issues was Real ID. And that's this federally mandated program, as you said, by October 1st, 2020. If you want to go to an airport, board a plane without having the hassle of bringing your passport, you're going to need this new special card. So right now, there's this fear that this looming deadline is coming. And if the DMV can't get more and more people to get these real IDs, there's going to be this huge surge in people coming into their offices. So some of the problems that we've seen so far really come back to technology and management. And there's a concern going forward that if the DMV isn't able to fix some of these problems, customers could be experiencing longer wait times.
Well, and also I wonder about just the morale of employees. When I visit my local DMV office, the employees look just like they're dragging. They look very unhappy, and it just seems like morale is low. And I wonder if there's anything in this report to address the limitations that management has on removing employees because of state job protections, and ways of trying to get more productivity out of DMV employees.
Sure. So one thing that we reported on was that point about employee frustration. So they've really been, according to this report, hampered by outdated and inadequate training and obsolete tools. So many employees feel handcuffed by the resources they have. There was a strike team report that was sent out in March, and there was a survey sent out to employees as part of that report that was produced during an audit. And employees had trouble even accessing the form because of Wi-Fi connectivity issues within their own office. So there's so many issues that employees are facing technologically that is making it more difficult for them to do their job. And at the same time, you're seeing lots of changes in leadership and management, where we've seen the former DMV director, Jun Tsuyamoto, depart in December. And then a month later, the acting director, Bill Davidson, depart. Now you have another acting director with Kathleen Webb, while Governor Newsom gets ready to try and find a new permanent replacement. So you have all these struggles with upper-level management and leadership changes. And at the same time, you're having to deal with employees who are really struggling to get their job done. But what the DMV would tell you and what the career civil servants I speak to would tell you is that they're doing their best with what they can and trying to make the best of a troublesome situation.
I'd love to hear from listeners your thoughts on it. If you've had dealings with the DMV, what do you think would significantly improve the performance of that department? What would enable it to give better customer service, to be able to more competently handle some of these very large-scale projects like Real ID, like Motor Voter? What suggestions do you have? I'll start it off. One of the things I'd love to see is, consumer surveys that after you go to the DMV, they ask you about how did it go? What problems did you find? What did you think of the attitude of the employee? So that you could provide the kind of feedback that often happens when you have customer service, with different companies. They ask you about what your experience was like. I'd love to see the DMV do that. But do you have a suggestion for what you think would improve the DMV? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brian, has the budget for the department kept pace over time with the demands customers for services?
Well, I think that depends on who you ask. If you talk to customers, they would probably say that we want to get in and out faster, and the DMV, if they need more money to get it done, so be it. The DMV could always benefit from more money. And you have lawmakers at the same time who have given money to the DMV that's been misspent in some cases. So there's little appetite among certain lawmakers to raise the budget for the DMV. So it all depends on who you ask. But right now, the governor is proposing a $163 million increase in the DMV's budget to address some ongoing problems. And right now, over the next month, it's going to be a battle within the legislature to see how much, if any, of that actually gets appropriated properly.
Is there anything, given that lack of trust of the legislature of DMV administration and the documented problems in the audit, including, you know, employees sleeping on the job and the like, is there anything that directly addresses the culture? Because the resource is pretty easy to understand, the antiquated computer system, all these things that impair the ability of employees to deliver the services they're expected to deliver. But is there the flip side of that, something that addresses cultural problems within the department?
Well, not in this specific 110-page report that I came across, besides just an outdated organizational structure, according to the report. But if you look at an audit that was released March 27th, they said the DMV had a, quote, reactive culture. And that just means when problems arise, you're reacting to them rather than proactively trying to address them as they before they even become an issue. So I think there's a reactive culture if you talk to some of these investigators who have really looked into the DMV's operations.
Elizabeth in West LA says, last time I was at my local DMV in Santa Monica, I was astonished how cheerful and friendly the workers were. They didn't have enough people working, but other than the wait, it went smoothly, and I got my real ID without any problem. So nice to hear a positive report like that. Elizabeth in West LA. Pippi writes on the page, the problem with the DMV is the antiquated method and a serious lack of personnel. That said, I was recently there to fix my registration. My check never received. The people were really nice. The woman that helped me forgave the late fees, but I still had to go to another window to actually pay and get my tags. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Share with us your suggestions for improving the Department of Motor Vehicle and to help them do their jobs more effectively. So, Brian, what if the legislature is reluctant to provide more resources, and yet everybody agrees that the department is having to deal with this clunky computer system, what's the solution?
So I think the legislature, if you talk to Democrats and Republicans, they would say first, no doubt, there's a need for more resources and there's a place for lawmakers to provide more financial resources. But I think the challenge is the timing and making sure that there's a proper, permanent, definitive leadership team in place to implement the changes that are being proposed and suggested. So it doesn't seem that there's going to be no money and no additional resources provided to the DMV. It looks like they'll get something. It's just a question of how much and when. But in the meantime, the DMV has done a number of things to address some of these concerns. For example, they're working on getting credit cards offered at DMV offices. So if you go online, you can pay by credit card. But if you go to a DMV office right now, you can't use your credit card. You got to have a debit, you got to have cash or some other form of payment. So they're already doing things to try and modernize their technology and improve their systems. Another issue was with tablets. They had received 500 tablets, but didn't really have Wi-Fi connectivity to get these tablets up and running and off the ground. So they're trying to improve the hardware in many of these offices across the state and get these tablets up and running. So those are just a couple of things that the DMV is already doing with its existing resources. But I think there's going to be an appetite to give them more money.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Brian Anderson, Sacramento Bee political reporter, who's been covering the Department of Motor Vehicle, the crises there over the past year with both motor voter registration and with the Real ID program. Thank you so much, Brian. Doug in Buena Park says, I'm a government employee. Larry's suggestion about accountability needs to happen. They told my son he failed his driving test. And we did get his license. 5 years later, he returned to renew. They couldn't find they'd ever issued him a license. Doug in Buena Park. All right, Doug, thanks very much. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we're going to take a look at how talking to strangers can actually boost your mood. When your parents said don't talk to strangers, that might not have been the best advice. We'll find out why right after a live update from No Stranger, Hedy Lynn Hurdies.
But I get so lonely, ain't got a man. to meet somebody any way I can.
See, I think Shamikia Copeland has the right idea. It actually makes sense to talk to strangers. And in fact, there's a bit of scientific evidence that it boosts our sense of well-being and our mood. As I've talked about on the program before, throughout my life, I tend to be someone who talks to strangers, try not to intrude, or someone's busy or rushed, not to interrupt. But I love talking with people and hearing what's going on with them and their stories. And I've always felt much more connected to the world as a result of doing that. And probably starting doing that as a teenager ultimately led me to this chair, talking with people every day, formally for 2 hours. But I was looking at a piece in the Wall Street Journal by Elizabeth Bernstein that described her experiences talking with strangers. And she found a psychologist and senior lecturer from the University of Essex in England, Gillian Sandstrom, who's actually researched talking with strangers. And Professor Sandstrom joins us. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about your research on this.
I'm going to say good evening. It's evening here in the UK.
Very good. We hope we're not keeping you up too late. So let's start with what assignment did you give to people as a part of this study to determine the effect of talking to strangers?
Well, I've run a bunch of different research studies, but the very first one I did on this topic, I did at Starbucks. And so I stood on the sidewalk with some research assistants, and as people were walking by the Starbucks store, we said, hey, we'll give you a Starbucks gift card if you'll help us out with a little bit of research. And so what we did is we asked some people when they went in to buy their coffee to just be as efficient as they could. We said, you know, the barista will be happy if you just make everything as easy as possible. So have your money ready and avoid unnecessary conversation. The other group of people, we said, when you go in and you buy your coffee, try to turn this instrumental interaction into a real social connection. So smile, make eye contact, and have a little chat. And then when they came out with their coffee, we asked them a few questions, and it turned out that people who had this minimal social interaction were in a better mood and just felt more connected to other people.
So that a small scale little study where you got a response. Then how did you parlay that into other studies of this subject?
Well, I just got really interested in talking to strangers. And so if we have all these benefits, if it feels good and it makes us feel connected, just like you described in your personal experience, and that's what I've experienced too, then why don't we do it more often? Why are so many people afraid to talk to strangers? I mean, we have the social message, stranger danger, but why aren't people doing it? So I started looking, trying to understand what exactly are people worried is going to happen. So I've been running some how to talk to strangers workshops. And so people in those workshops spend some time talking to someone they don't know. And we do a lot of brainstorming about how to start conversations, how to end them, etc. But before the workshop starts, I just ask people, what are you worried about today when you talk to this new person? And then I sort of turn that into a checklist, which I've used in a bunch of different studies. And so it turns out people are worried about all sorts of things. We're worried about what we're going to do during the interaction. So what we might talk too much, or we might talk too little, or we might say the wrong thing. We also worry about what our partner is going to do. We worry about how we're going to feel, if we're going to be bored or anxious or feel kind of awkward. We worry about how the other person's going to feel, and we're just not sure if we're capable of it. We worry about how are we going to start the conversation? How are we going to keep it going? And the hardest part for me is how to end it. And I've talked to people who've had the same problem. You get people going and they keep talking and it's hard to walk away.
So true. And, you know, the other thing, Gillian, I was going to say is, to do it effectively, you have to be able to read other people and to pick up subtle cues, to get a sense from their motions, from their facial expressions, from their pace of activities. Are they in a hurry? Are they in a mood to talk with someone? Is there someone next to them they may, you know, be planning to start a conversation with them momentarily? And not everybody feels confident in their ability to read the situation and to read someone else.
Mm. Yeah, I'm no body language expert, but I'm sure you're right that when we, it makes sense to choose someone to talk to based on what you're seeing from their body language and other things. So I don't, you know, personally, when I talk to strangers, I don't usually approach someone who's got earbuds in or is busy reading. Although sometimes I can't help myself and I need to know what are they reading and how is it?
Yeah.
But yeah, some people pretty clearly send a message that they don't want to talk.
I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. If you're someone who does talk with people, just as you go about the course of your day to strangers, you know, someone pumping gas at the next pump to yours, someone who's in the same aisle with you at the supermarket, you see him looking for something, do you chat people up on a fairly regular basis, maybe even looking for opportunities for a brief conversation, but some sort of connection? Or are you someone who doesn't feel particularly confident about doing that and wants to talk about that issue? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. One of the things that I find is that people like telling you about themselves. So often they like sharing about themselves. You know, as I've talked about on the air before, when I do a road trip with my family, my wife, Kristen, says, okay, you know, you're going into the store. Please come right back off. We need to get back on the road, because she knows that sometimes when I go through that door, I start talking with someone and, oh, well, tell me about this town and, you know, what kind of work is there? What's the economy based on? And, you know, how many visitors do you get? And I start interviewing them. And people love to tell you about where they live, what it's like to live there, what brought them there, whether they grew up there. And you learn so much more about a place from the people than just looking at it as an outsider. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue in just 1 minute. You got to be careful exchanging those glances, though. You don't want to give the wrong impression when you chat up strangers. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're joined by Gillian Sandstrom, senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex. Excuse me, not the University of Essex. Well, that'd be a good school to attend. I'd like to go there. That sounds a lot of fun to me. The school is in Colchester, England, and Gillian studies interactions between strangers and finds that it's a mood elevator. People feel more connected with the world when they open themselves up or initiate conversation with strangers. 866-893-KPCC to join us. Will in Hollywood says, for me, talking to strangers, bit hard at first, but it gets easier as I do it more and more. It's not something that I, you know, feel better about when I make myself, or I do feel better about it when I make myself do it. I think other people are like that too. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And let us know your thoughts of this. Yvonne writes, I'm always talking to strangers. I think it's polite and neighborly, as it were. I've been doing that ever since I was a kid. I guess I hate those awkward silences. If you're walking down the street, we make eye contact. Guess what? I'm going to greet you, so get used to it. Let's talk with Ellen, who joins us from Medford, Oregon. Ellen, great to have you with us. So are you someone who talks with strangers?
I do all the time, and I'm now retired. I had a job as a criminal defense attorney, so of course I was talking to strangers on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Did investigations. And I'm married to somebody who would rather stick needles in his eyes than talk to strangers.
And is this something you've always done?
Yes. I was always a nosy child who would walk up to a complete stranger and just blab away about whatever, ask a lot of questions, really interested in what they were doing and why they were doing it and how long they were going to do it and how could I do it too.
So, and it sounds like you relocated to Medford, is that right?
I did, and I stuck with my favorite radio station, which I support and everybody should support. I even donated my car to you guys.
Hey, thank you, Ellen. I appreciate it. So when you moved to Medford, did you find any difference, either better or worse, for acceptance of talking to strangers?
That's a good question, because visually I don't look like a lot of Medford people. And once I – because I looked like, you know, what I was, a lawyer from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Medford is a smaller city, and there's a lot of people here who dress casually all the time. So once I dressed down and stopped wearing makeup and kind of let my hair grow, I had a much better reception than when I looked like my lawyer self.
That's funny. So it is one of us sort of thing. Ellen, I appreciate it. Great to have you with us from Medford, Oregon, listening to 89.3 KPECC, probably through the smartphone app, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jillian Sandstrom, because you're working with students at the university you're at, do you detect any generational difference when it comes to talking with strangers?
Let's see. I'm not usually sort of asking people how often they do it. I'm putting them in the situation and forcing them to do it and seeing how they think it's going to go and how it actually goes. So I don't really have an answer to your question.
All right. I'd be interested in listeners what you think of that. Are younger Angelinos more or less likely to talk with strangers, or about the same? Is that something that hasn't necessarily changed? 866-893-KPCC. Lisa in Agoura, are you someone comfortable with talking with people you don't know?
Oh, yes. I love talking to people. I was just telling the friend person that whenever my kids are with me, they despise going anywhere with me because they know it'll take twice as long because I'm always talking to someone. It'll be about anything. It'll be about what they're purchasing or just about the weather. I love it. I mean, it's great.
Oh, that's terrific. Lisa, do your kids think that you talk at all is a problem, or you do it too much? You know, when I was a kid growing up, my grandmother Mantle was someone who not only talked with people, she would give lengthy explanations for something with the greatest amount of detail. And as a kid, it's like, oh, my God, should she have to go into such a is that kind of how they feel, or they're just uncomfortable with you broaching things with people?
I think, you know, it just depends, because sometimes I will get a little lengthy. If the person, you know, is interested in actually talking about it, they'll roll their eyes, they'll look at me, you know, we got to go somewhere. But sometimes I bring them actually into my conversation, and then that opens a whole other can of worms.
Oh, buddy. Elisa, great to have you with us. JF writes on the page, I've always talked to strangers. When I visited my daughter at university in New York City, I talked to strangers. However, my daughter said, Mom, don't do that here. People will think you're crazy. It's so funny because my father-in-law was visiting my sister-in-law in New York City, and they had a similar conversation. My father-in-law loves talking with people. He's a very friendly, very charming guy. And so he was doing in that in New York. And his daughter, my sister-in-law, is saying, Dad, you know, it's New York. You know, he just kept on doing it and made all kinds of friends. It worked great for him, even in NYC. 866-893-KPECC. Molly in Hollywood, how often do you approach people and talk to strangers?
I love talking to strangers. And I've actually met a lot of friends who live in England because I've met them talking to them as strangers in L.A., and then we keep in touch, and I visit them there. They visit us here. And my husband and I met a wonderful woman a few years ago when we were traveling in Swanage in Dorset. And we just were standing next to her at a cab stand, and we started a conversation. And we've seen each other now 3 or 4 times at her little hometown in England.
That's wonderful. My mother has experiences like this, meeting people and travel. The next thing, they're, you know, friends for years afterward. Very similar to what you described. Molly, thank you. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kim in Silver Lake, I understand that you've got a one-year-old baby and that changed everything for you?
Yes. So I have a one-year-old, and I'm somebody that would usually be the one to initiate conversation. I love talking with people, But I found that since having my kid, everybody wants to talk to me. They want to see the baby. How old is she? Is it a boy or a girl? Because I don't dress her one way or another. And it sparks all kinds of conversations about everything. And it's been fascinating. And I've absolutely loved the engagement on both sides. So it's not always me kind of initiating the conversation.
So do you think now, now that you've gotten going with that, when you don't have your prop, your child with you, that you'll continue that?
Yes. I feel like I'm less wanted in a way, and like nobody really approaches me as much, but I still chat with people just the same as the previous caller mentioned. I talk to people while traveling, and I've made so many friends around the world that way. And so I'm always somebody that's going to talk to you. And if you give me the cold shoulder, well, that's your problem.
All right. Good for you, Kim. I appreciate and congratulations on your one-year-old. McKenna in Highland Park says, I love talking to strangers. It changes your day. I used to drive for Lyft and I'd have conversations for 10, 20 minutes with passengers. It's amazing. And Sarah in the city of Orange says, I'm from Iowa. This is how all of us are. We also have two very friendly two-year-olds that drive my husband crazy how much we talk to strangers. Sarah, thanks so much. And Jillian Sandstrom, a senior lecturer at the University of Essex in Colchester, England, thank you for being with us and talking about your research. A great way to prompt these terrific calls from listeners. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have much more to come in our second hour. I'll tell you about it shortly. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Later this hour, we're going to take a look at the troubled state of the LA Lakers basketball team. They do have a new coach. We're going to talk about who he is and what his pedigree is. We'll also look at the challenges atop the organization with its leadership just a couple days away from the NBA's lottery to determine the draft order. And then we're going to talk about Generation Z slang. What are some of the most recent terms to be introduced among younger Americans? We'll find out about that too. But first, speaking of younger Americans, we talk about the LA Unified School District. Joining us, KPCC, K-12 education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Kyle, good morning.
Good to be here. I am a younger American.
Yes, you are. You are too.
I don't know
I meant the district, but yes, you are as well.
Yes, I am. I know.
You are certainly younger than me. So we have a runoff in District 5, which has been unrepresented for quite a few months now.
It has been unrepresented. This is the seat that Ref Rodriguez, who is the school board member last year was pled guilty to charges related to his campaign finances of his 2015 election campaign. So he resigned last year amid all of that scandal. And there was this sort of question, like, what do we do with this seat? Back last summer, the school board wrestled with the issue and basically couldn't come up with a temporary appointment to fill out the term. There's really only about 18 months left on it now at this point. So instead of temporarily appointing someone, the school board opted to hold a special election, which is what we have right now. There are two candidates who are running in that special election, and this is to fill this, again, unfilled seat that has been open for many months now that represents sort of this weird district that covers both Northeast L.A. and Southeast L.A.
You mean geographically weird.
Geographically
we're
weird,
no
I should say.
About the residents
that's right.
of the district.
Yeah, exactly. All the weird, you know, slime monsters that... No, so Northeast L.A., like Los Feliz, up through Eagle Rock and Highland Park, and then sort of connected by a very thin sliver of East L.A. down to the Southeast cities like Huntington Park, Bell, Cudahy, Southgate. And those are the areas that are going out to vote today.
And the two in the runoff, a former multi-office holder, Jackie Goldberg,
right?
Whose name recognition, I'm sure, among at least older voters had to have helped her. Heather Repening, the other candidate, former aide to Mayor Eric Garcetti. How big was the initial field in this race?
The initial field was 10 candidates. So these are the two candidates who emerged from a very big primary. Sometimes they call those jungle primaries. It really was kind of just like everyone out there, you know, kind of hacking through the wilderness to get through. Jackie Goldberg had no trouble of it. She almost got the 50% she needed to avoid a runoff. But, you know,
which is incredible. incredible.
Even with a field of 10 candidates.
That's astonishing.
And Heather Repenning was the second place finisher with 13% of the vote. And so Jackie Goldberg got more votes than, most of the rest of the candidates combined. And certainly, you know, the top two finisher, the two and three finishers only got about 13% of the vote each. Heather Repenning only squeaked into the runoff by about 31 votes.
So has she been bothering to put on much of a campaign for the runoff, or is it because of Goldberg showing the first time out is the assumption that
there is an assumption that this is Jackie Goldberg's race to lose here, especially when you come in with a 48-13 edge from the primary campaign. I think there is an assumption that, again, this is Jackie Goldberg's race to lose. But Heather Repenning has a lot of things going for her. She's got the endorsement of L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, which I think has come with it about the endorsements of a bunch of trade unions that sort of have all come together to throw together their endorsements. And that has come with, you know, so she can send out this mailer with a long list of endorsers on it. She also has the support of SEIU Local 99, which is the union that represents a lot of the non-teaching employees in LAUSD. They have traditionally been the third largest outside spender in school board races. And outside spending means a lot because the individual candidates can't really raise enough on their own to cover a district as large and diverse as an LAUSD school board district. So the outside money means a lot. She has benefited from about $1.3 million in spending from SEIU, both on ads and campaigning for on her behalf, as well as some negative ads sent out against one of her primary challengers and Jackie Goldberg, who has the support of another well-heeled challenger, deep-pocketed outside spender, the Teachers Union.
UTLA.
And that's been sort of the driving factors here. SEIU and UTLA going head-to-head in this school board race by trying to support Goldberg on one hand and Repenting on the other.
One of my fondest memories on Air Talk was interviewing Jackie Goldberg years ago, and I so enraged her by some, you know, raising a point of view from people who were critical of that she uttered an expletive on the air that we couldn't bleep fast enough.
Oh, boy. So, and you heard from the FCC about
so
that,
we,
I'm sure.
We did, but we talked about it afterwards. Said, oh, I didn't realize I was on the air at that time.
I'm sure. She is quite a firebrand. And I think that this is sort of one of the – so if this is Jackie Goldberg's race to lose, Jackie Goldberg has been very outspoken, for instance, in her criticism of the current board. She went before the board back when they were hiring Austin Buettner back in May of 2018 and really laid into the board for the way that they handled the hiring process. She had not only strong words for Ref Rodriguez, who was on the board at the time, she also said to the rest of the board that they were, quote unquote, bought and paid for, specifically directing her criticism at the board members that were endorsed previously by the California Charter Schools Association. Of course, Goldberg being a teachers union appointee.
I was going to say, well, as though there's not money on the other side. But so is this potentially going to shift the balance of power then for the board?
Well, so I think that it's important to separate the way the board actually operates from the way that the board politics of the elections are held. Obviously, in the electoral sense, this would give the teachers union another candidate to sort of support their cause, or another member of the board to support their cause. There's sort of a loose coalition of before Ref Rodriguez resigned, of 4 to 5 members who were endorsed by the Charter Schools Association at one point, really a solid 4-vote block of charter supporters. With Ref Rodriguez leaving, that left the board with 3 kind of, you know, quote unquote, solidly, you know, pro-charter candidates currently on the board. And Jackie Goldberg being a teachers union endorsement, that would certainly be sort of a shift in the overall makeup in the board. It would make a big difference in terms of how, you know, the board is perceived and what kinds of policies can go through the board. On the other hand, I think we've seen a balance of power already shift, especially given the way that the teachers union strike went this last January. So there's an amount of the shift that if Goldberg were to be elected would take place. But some of that shift is already baked in because the politics around charter schools have already changed. We've seen state legislation as well. But if you want to talk about a feather in the cap, if Goldberg were to be able to go through, that certainly would be a feather in the teachers union's cap.
We're talking about District 5, L.A. Unified School District Board, the runoff election today between Jackie Goldberg and Heather Repenning. Also in 3 weeks, coming up on June 4th, there'll be a parcel tax on the ballot for those within the boundaries of the L.A. Unified School District. And this requires two-thirds voter support.
That's right. So two-thirds of voters would be required to pass this Measure EE, which is a 16-cent per square foot parcel tax, so sort of like a property tax, would be on all LAUSD property holders is where this tax would be levied. What exactly it would be levied on is now actually the subject of a lawsuit that was filed by the anti-tax group, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which generally opposes local government tax increases. And they contend that the school board did not vote on the language that is appearing on the ballot. And there's this, it's a highly technical difference between the district initially. What the school board voted on was taxing habitable square footage. I think there was an intention that they didn't want to, for instance, tax parking garages. But the way that the language was changed after the school board vote, the superintendent made a change to it. It was sort of technical in nature, but now it sort of makes it look like every structure on the land on a piece of property could be taxed. So there's this sort of technical difference here. The school board had to pass a resolution to specifically say we don't want to tax garages. I can say here 16 cents a square foot for a parcel tax, but there is sort of a question about what that tax would apply to.
Is there any sense, Kyle, of when a court might decide on, because if we're coming up the election in 3 weeks, it would be nice to know the status of the measure before people vote.
And of course, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association was actually suing in hopes of stopping the election. There will be a hearing 2 days after Election Day, which is, again, June 4th, to basically decide the questions that are at stake here, because I think that it is the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association's intent that this measure not actually get implemented at all. So there is sort of this cloud that's hanging now over the parcel tax measure as it goes forward, over this question of whether the school board actually authorized it to go forward in its current form or whether staff changed it before it was sent to the ballot.
Kyle, there's also the question of where the money raised from the parcel tax will go, because the district has given one account of what the funds will be used for, but some of the critics of the parcel tax have said what this really is about is backfilling the increases to teachers, and it's going to go in strictly into personnel.
Well, setting aside sort of the framing of how the money is going to be spent, you know, the facts are that it would not be there is only really one bucket of things that this money cannot be spent on, and that is on facilities and school construction and renovation.
So it's
that's
not
the
a
only thing. It is
bond
not a capital
measure.
Bond, which would need a smaller threshold to pass if the district were to go that route. This is for operating funding. And all of the districts, operating funding, is sort of, you can move
fungible,
a lot of
yeah.
it around. It's sort of fungible. And this is a district that has a lot of financial challenges. Some of them are structural in nature, like the fact that the enrollment in LAUSD has been declining precipitously for more than a decade now. That means a loss in per student funding and sort of a cascade of impacts from that. There are increasing pension and health care costs, which we hear a lot about, and there is criticism, and that's kind of what you're referring to there, Larry, from the sort of no on EE camp, that the district hasn't done enough to get those costs under control. But there are also other things that, during the teachers' strike, a lot of people stood up and said, yeah, I agree with the teachers. We do need lower class sizes. We do. It is kind of weird that we don't have a nurse on site every single day in LAUSD schools. Part of what the teachers' union settlement was about was about changing some of those facts, lowering class sizes, putting more support staff on campuses. The district needs to find the money in order to pay for those things. Otherwise, in the coming years, they're going to have to scale back on some of those promises or negotiate with the teachers union to scale back. So that's also what this money could be going for as well. That's what the district would say is what that money is going to go for, is to try and make the teachers union deal, the deal that ended the teachers strike, paid for.
Don in Playa Wyatt Array said he thought that money was going for improvements of existing buildings, but I assume that's capital, right?
There's,
if it's going, can you use it for that?
I believe there's language in the ballot measure that actually says the opposite, that
it
is not that
it
is not able for
structurally.
It is not for that's the one thing that it can't be used on. The thing that it includes very broad language about what it can be spent on, for everything from teaching and learning to other operating costs. But capital is the one thing that it specifically says in the text it cannot be used on.
Kyle, thank you so much for the update on today's District 5 runoff election between Jackie Goldberg and Heather Repenning, and for previewing 3 weeks from today the parcel tax that'll be on the ballot for voters within the LA Unified School District. We appreciate it.
Of course, thanks.
KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes with us. Coming up, the future of the Lakers. They've just formally announced they have a new head coach. He's coached for a couple of other NBA franchises and has had some degree of success. But is it at the level that a Laker coach would be typically expected to have? We'll find out coming up in a moment. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to be looking at Generation Z's slang terms so you can be up to date on the latest expressions. But right now, it's the struggles of the LA Lakers, years without a playoff appearance after firing head coach Luke Walton. The Lakers looked set to sign former Laker Tyronn Lue as their head coach, the former Cleveland Cavaliers coach. That fell through in the negotiations, and Frank Vogel, former head coach for the Indiana Pacers and Orlando Magic, is the choice. With us to talk about the decision, as well as ongoing travails in Lakers management, is A. Martinez of Take Two, for many years the host of Laker pre- and post-game radio coverage. A., good morning.
Hey, Larry.
What do you think of Frank Vogel as the choice?
If there had been different circumstances, it wouldn't be that bad of a choice, because he has had success. He's a very defensive-minded coach and knows how to handle big names and big egos. Paul George, who is a superstar now with the Oklahoma City Thunder, considers him one of the most influential people he's had in his career. So on the surface, yes, but then we have to kind of dig a little bit deeper, and it's a 3-year contract, which is essentially tied to the last 3 years that LeBron James has on his deal. So you got to think, okay, is he tied to LeBron? If this doesn't work out and LeBron leaves, does Frank Vogel leave along with him? So even though they made a hire, Larry, it still feels very unstable.
Well, and it was the length of the contract that sounds like it was one of the biggest parts of the deal breaker with Tyronn Lue.
Yeah, because think about this. Let's just Luke Walton, for example, who just was let go, or at least left the Lakers for the Sacramento Kings. He got a 5-year deal, and he has arguably a less successful resume than Frank Vogel, and he gets 5 years in Sacramento. Meanwhile, the Lakers hiring their brand new head coach only offer 3 years. And it seems, Larry, that that was a sticking point with everyone they talked to. They wanted to just give 3 years to everyone that that they interviewed. And Frank Vogel, I guess, said fine, which is surprising. But I guess when you need a job, you need a job.
Arash Markazi, also with us, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Arash, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts about Vogel's hiring?
I do like Vogel as a coach, but as A mentioned, it's a tough circumstance for him in two fronts. Number one, there's definitely public knowledge that he was the third choice. They went after Monty Williams, then Ty Lue. In fact, gave Ty Lue the same three-year deal. He turned that down. And then also the addition of Jason Kidd is a curious one, in the sense that Jason Kidd wanted that head coaching job, and there's a clear perception that because he was handpicked for Vogel, that he is Vogel's successor. That is a very tough situation for him to coach under, when it is, again, known around the league and by the fan base that this guy that the team has handpicked to be your top assistant is trying to get your job.
Well, and when I think of Jason Kidd, I also think of an emphasis on defense. And so you've got Vogel, who's a defensive-minded head coach. Kidd on his staff is defensive-minded. Arash, how does that make sense in terms of balancing the leadership?
I mean, I think they've always been fine offensively, and quite frankly, when you have a LeBron James, that's not
take care of itself.
My biggest problem with this team. Defensively, that has been their Achilles heel. They have just been such a poor defensive team. The other reason you bring in Jason Kidd is because of Lonzo Ball. I mean, if Lonzo Ball has a ceiling or somewhere, so someone that he should aspire to be, it is Jason Kidd. So he was not only brought in maybe, again, to be the future coach of the team, but also to tutor Lonzo Ball to be a exceptional point guard.
All right. Your thoughts about how this whole coaching search was conducted?
It's like ripping off a Band-Aid and the wound is not healed, anywhere near healed. That's what it's felt like. And what we've seen now is that Rob Pelinka, the general manager of the Lakers, who used to be Kobe Bryant's agent, I think now has established himself as someone with a lot of power in the organization. He's charting out this hire as maybe one that defines him. Look, they could still make it work. They've got a lot of money under the salary cap to try and attract a max contract free agent, someone like superstar Kyrie Irving. Maybe they can still pull off that Anthony Davis deal that they couldn't pull off a few months ago. And if they do all that, Larry, everything's fine.
The world is spinning correctly again.
All of this doesn't matter. But considering the recent track record of this front office, that's a 50-50 chance at best if they can fix it.
Why do you think that Jeannie Buss is so enamored of Rob Pelinka? Because things that I read are that he's not highly regarded by his peers.
No, and he was Kobe Bryant's longtime agent, so it's someone that's been in the Lakers' atmosphere for a while. And I think one thing that we've seen with Jeannie is that she seems to really enjoy having a comfort around her. She doesn't bring in new people. Rob Pelinka, someone she's known for a very long time. Linda Rambis, Kurt Rambis, those are two advisors that she's known for 30, 40 years. So I think because of the familiarity with Rob Pelinka, I think that's why he has the kind of weight that he now does in the organization.
Magic Johnson's leaving, was that largely over him not being able to fire Rob Pelinka?
Well, that and apparently he wasn't being Magic. Magic likes being very gregarious on social media, likes tweeting about players, likes talking about players, and that's something as an executive that he was not allowed to do as per NBA league rules. So I think he's now free to be what he wants, and I think that power struggle between Rob Pelinka and Magic Johnson really showed itself in the last few months.
Arash, is there any chance that the team is going to bring in a replacement at Magic's position to run the whole organization over Pelinka?
Well, that was the column that I wrote in today's Times. I mean, that they really need an experience person in that position. When Jeannie Buss put Magic and Rob together, you had two people who had never had that job before, two people who had never run a team before. So listen, if she truly does like Rob, and she does, it's only right for her to bring in someone else who's had that position before, whether it's a Jerry West or someone who's run a team. So it doesn't look like she will right now. I mean, again, they've hired the coach, they've hired the coaching staff. Normally the line of thinking would be, okay, bring in a president and then have that person hire the coach. Well, they've already brought in the coach.
Yeah.
So at this point, I think that ship has sailed.
All right. Hey, before I let you go, just your thoughts. What would you ideally like to see the team do now?
If they can somehow swing some superstars their way, that would be nice. They still have a shot at Kyrie Irving. He seems like he wants to play with LeBron James. He's talking about maybe coming to the Lakers if he can swing it, and then make that big trade if they can for Anthony Davis. You bring in big names to Hollywood, Larry?
Yeah.
Everything's fine.
All is right again. Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks.
A. Martinez joining us from Take Two, longtime Laker pre- and post-game host for ESPN LA. We continue this conversation with LA Times sports columnist Arash Markazi with us, and I'd love to hear from you if you're a Laker fan, what you think the franchise needs to get its mojo back. We're at 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Arash, there's also, a 2% chance that we get the top draft pick?
That is a big moment for this team. If they get that top draft pick, that really accelerates their chances of improving the team. Not because of just Zion Williamson, but they could flip that pick for Anthony Davis, who is believed to be, you know, one of the top five or six players in the league. So, again, that's just a 2% chance, but this is sort of like the next moment on the calendar when you look at these dates of how they can improve the team. First, it's the lottery, then it's the draft, and then July 1st, as we mentioned, they have a max slot to bring in a superstar player. Now the question is, can they attract that superstar?
Yeah, and what's your sense of what other superstars in the league think about playing alongside LeBron James? Is that exciting to them because he's still so gifted and, you know, his skills have not appreciably eroded? Or is the feeling that that limits their influence when you've got, you know, the A player is obviously going to be James?
Exactly. So, I mean, I think it'll be a little bit like their coaching search, unfortunately, for the team. They will not, you know, listen, there's three big names, perhaps, for example, and I don't think they're going to get the top two. Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard are going to go someplace else. Maybe they get a Jimmy Butler. Maybe they get Kemba Walker. Kyrie is someone that they've talked about. But, again, it's a weird situation for the Story franchise to be in because it was such a destination team for so many years. And now for so many coaches and players, it's seemingly like their third choice.
Yeah, and to what do you attribute that? Is that the LeBron factor? Is it the management of the team? Is it that they've missed the playoff years? Or all of these conspiring against the perception that it's an elite place to come?
No, I think it's two things. Number one, the stability that had been there for a number of years where, you know, they were always a playoff team. They were always a championship contender. You had Dr. Jerry Buss, who ran the show, but Jerry West ran the team, and you either had Pat Riley or Phil Jackson. That stability is not there. You know, when you look at who talked to the coaches, it was a contingent of seven people. It was Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka and Kurt Rambis and Linda Rambis and Joey Buss and Jesse Buss and Tim Harrison. It's like no one knows who's running the show. And number two, Larry, 6 years, you don't make the playoffs. You're talking about a franchise when you go back to when they began in Minneapolis. From Minneapolis to 2012, they had only missed the playoffs a total of 5 years. They're going on 6 years they have not made the playoffs. So when you have that consistency of not being good, suddenly people forget that you were the gold standard for years and years and years.
We're talking with Arash Markazi, LA Times columnist, talking about the future of the Lakers. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Rob writes on the page, let's see. Lou takes a ragtag team with one superstar to the NBA Finals. Vogel finished setting the demolition charges on the Magic, blew them up. Silver lining, aftermarket Laker tickets will be cheap to buy. So Rob's not impressed. Lucille writes on the page, Jerry, we miss you so much. Talking about Jerry Buss, the late Lakers owner. 866-893-KPCC. Michael in Huntington Beach says, why isn't Jeannie Buss under pressure? Her dad brought Kobe in, the last star of the Lakers before LeBron was Kobe. The last time they were good was Kobe. So what is she doing? Arash, is Jeannie Buss feeling pressure, do you think? Because we haven't seen her be out front as they've been going through this process.
100%. And I think that's something that she has to do. On Monday, they will have the press conference for the coach. We are expecting Rob Pelinka and Vogel to talk. But Jeannie Buss needs to address the media at some point about the direction of the team, the thought process that went into the coaching staff, the thought process that went into having those seven people in the room talking to the coaches. Listen, you know, this team is in a tough position right now, and she is getting pressure, but I think that there's more confusion than, you know, people want to know, what is your plan for the team? And so Jeannie has always done such a great job with the media. I think now is the time for her at some point within the next week or so to have her own press conference and address these questions.
The Lakers are, you know, sort of their self-contained business. They're not owned by a conglomerate, obviously. And with the lack of playoff games, that has to hit them in terms of revenue. Yeah, they've got a huge TV contract. They sell out every game. They have all kinds of money from marketing tie-ins and advertising. Nonetheless, for 6 years straight to lose those playoff games and all those tickets, it's a lot, isn't it, Arash?
100%, Larry, 100% right. And not only that, when they signed their deal with Spectrum, as you remember, you know, their games on the road at least were available on Channel 9 locally. It's not anymore. They have not won a single playoff game since they've signed that contract 7 years ago. They can't be happy about that. Local in terms of ticket sales, concessions, merchandise, whatnot, that all takes a hit when you have zero playoff games. So, again, no one thought that they would be in this position for this long. No one thought they would be in this position last July when they signed LeBron James. Everyone thought this was the beginning of the turnaround. So for them to be just as bad as they were last season as they have been in the past was shocking.
Absolutely. Arash, thanks so much. By the way, really enjoy your column in the Times. It's must reading for me. Thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Arash Markazi, L.A. Times sports columnist. If you haven't caught his column, it's truly outstanding every day in the Times. A. Martinez, host of Take Two here on KPCC, also joining us in conversation. Coming up, what's some of the new slang that Gen Z frequently uses? We'll learn about that after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies.
When you notice the stripes, the dirt in your thrives, hope it's right when you die. Old and bony, dawn breaks like a bull through the hall. Never should have called, but my head's to the wall and I'm lonely.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We love to talk about language, and I know so many Air Talk listeners enjoy the segments that we do, talking about new words, expansion of dictionaries, phrases that have fallen by the wayside in recent years. There's a sociology teacher at Lowell, Massachusetts High School who has been teaching for 15 years and so interested with every new generation of students at the slang that they use, the language that they bring into the classroom and onto campus, that he actually recently has put together a Gen Z slang dictionary, which has gone viral on the internet. James Callahan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate it. So, tell us a little bit about your interest, and throughout your teaching career, have you just been writing down these terms and documenting them?
Well, I just recently started writing them down. I mean, I've always been interested because a huge part of my job is being able to communicate with my students. So it helps if I understand some of the, you know, the slang terms that they're using in their everyday language. And those have changed over the years. I mean, I started teaching in 2004, and some of the words that they used back then are no longer in, you know, the teen vernacular. And so they change so frequently, and I've just kind of tried to keep up with it in my mind. But over the last couple of years, some of my students have asked me why I haven't actually written down or kept a document open to, you know, kind of compile this list. And so in September of this year, I just decided to start one, and I've been kind of building it slowly with my students. It started out with nothing. It's just a blank document. And now I think it's got about 70 or 75 terms or so.
Well, and originally you kept this private. You weren't thinking of sharing this with the world.
No, I mean, it was just for me. It was just my document. And, you know, it was a way for me to kind of understand what my students were saying. I never intended for it to be shared with anyone else. It just happened to be a day 2 weeks ago when all this started. My students were talking about music and the difference between the words bops and jams. And, you know, I was like, well, let's throw this into the dictionary and explain to me the difference. And so it was sort of mirrored on the monitors in my classroom. And one of my students just happened to snap a picture of it and put it on Twitter. And You know, the rest is history. It just kind of took off. So it wasn't expected.
I have a 17-year-old, but his vocabulary more approaches 1940s high school than 2019. So we're going to get into some of these words so that I can learn them too. But I'd love to hear from you if you're a parent of Gen Z or if you're someone of Gen Z and you want to share some of the words that you hear that have come into recent vocabulary. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. When did you find out that this list had become an internet sensation?
I think it was maybe not last week, but the week before. It was like a Wednesday morning. I woke up like I normally do at 5 a.m., only I looked at my phone and my phone was blowing up with text messages and emails from friends and former students that, you know, that I had that said, "You're famous on Twitter now." And I had no idea. It was just, to me, just another Wednesday morning. And I was just going to go through my regular routine of getting up and preparing for school. But yeah, it just kind of just all of a sudden happened.
All right. Do you have a couple of favorite words to start us out on, Mr. Callahan?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I should point out, like, I don't use these words. Like, they're not mine for usage. It's more just, you know, because it's teenage language, and I just am using it as a way of understanding. So I'm not trying to appropriate the words. It's more just for me to, you know what my students are talking about. But I guess my recent favorite is probably snack. And that is, you know, I always thought of a snack as like some small amount of food that you would eat between meals. But to teenagers, a snack is an attractive person or a person who looks good. So to me, that's just amazing how students or teenagers can take a word and give it a completely different meaning.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I should be careful how I say this word, schlitty. What does that mean?
Again, according to the dictionary, it means like a good time. And that was, I think, a conversation I had with a student on like a Monday morning. And I, you know, students filtering into the classroom, one of them sat down and I was like, "Oh, hey, how was your weekend?" And he said, "Oh, it was schlitty." And I was like, "I have no idea what."
What? Say what?
Can you explain that to me? And, you know, he was just like, "Let's just say it was a good time." So it may have some other meaning, but as far as I understand it, it's just, you know, an enjoyable event or weekend or something.
All right. And how do you know that they're being straight with you about the meaning of these words and not either, you know, joking with you about it or making it perhaps more innocuous than the word really is?
I mean, in my experience, I've found that the students have actually enjoyed helping me come to or creating a certain definition that that I can understand. So it's actually, in a way, kind of a fun little experiment with them. I challenge them to try to explain it as an adult would explain it to another person. So without using slang terms, you know, I try to get them to put it into sort of like a more simple language in a way for, you know, your everyday person to understand. So they do have some kind of, you know, they participate in coming up with the definitions and having some kind of ownership with it. So they could be putting one over on me, but, you know, in my experience with them, they seem to have really enjoyed kind of helping me build this this list and this dictionary.
All right, let me share some other ones that are on our guest, James Callahan, high school sociology teacher's list. Some of these may be familiar to you, flexed on, the game, hop off, John, low key, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, on blast, sis, slaps, let's see, take the L. I'm so curious how some of these ever get coined. Take the L, by the way, means to willingly make a sacrifice. Do you have any idea where the origination of that?
Yeah, so that was like, you know, a student of mine, you know, there was an assignment due, and they came into class and, you know, it was like a project. I'm like, oh, well, you know, project's due today. Do you have it? And the student was like, well, no, mister, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to take the L on that one. And I'm like, take the L. I'm like, all right, what does that mean? And she's like, well, sort of like sports. I'm going to take the loss, or like, I'm just going to make that sacrifice and accept that, you know, I didn't do the project. So I will take the poor grade. I'll make that sacrifice and just accept it for what it is.
All right. Again, we're at 866-893-KPCC. We're talking with a teacher at Lowell High School, Lowell, Massachusetts. Sociology is his area that he teaches. James Callahan, who with the encouragement of his students has put together a Gen Z online dictionary that's become very popular online. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. You can share with us your thoughts on this. We're going to just take a 1 minute break. We got some good calls lined up, listener input. We'll be back on AirTalk. Gen Z slang is our subject with high school teacher James Callahan, sociology teacher at Lowell, Massachusetts High School. His Gen Z slang dictionary, which he just started as a private list to educate himself about some of the terms that his students were using. They suggested he make it available, and he did. And the next thing he knew, it became an internet sensation. He's talking with us now and sharing some of the words he's learned along the way in his 15-year-long high school teaching career. Let's talk with Joanna in Claremont. And I understand you're actually a linguist and an editor, so I assume you have a lot of interest in this. Joanna, what have you learned?
Yes, I was a foreign language major, and I always take great interest in watching language evolve over the years. I'm in my 40s now, but I don't have any children myself, but I have a slew of nieces and nephews, and the oldest is 16. And it's just hysterical to me to constantly see all the new little things coming up. I mean, most of them, it seems to me, these days are based solely in technology, because everything she is saying comes from the way she texts or ways she picks things up on Instagram or different like social media platforms. She actually, what we would have said in frustration, like, ugh, she says it like, because that's them hitting a bunch of keys on the keyboard in frustration. She actually vocalizes it. And I think that's hysterical. She also abbreviates everything. She said something to me the other day. I was kind of speaking to her for a while, and she said, wow. She's like, Auntie, dropping tea. And I said, I'm sorry. She goes, oh, you don't know what tea is? It's truth. Truth bombs. I said, oh, okay, gotcha. Like, it's tea for short.
How funny. So
But the most interesting one, I think, is how they appropriate words that already exist and kind of give them new meaning. They don't know the roots of them. They use Stan, the word Stan, which is from that Eminem song back many, many years ago, that kind of represents a fan who's obsessive and, you know, just like, but they think, and they've decided that it stands for stalker fan.
Yeah.
An amalgamation of stalker fan. So I was telling him, this is actually a word we use, you know.
Oh, funny.
Eminem.
Just repurposed. Joanna, thanks so much. I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Danica in Santa Monica says, interesting how black culture permeates society more and more. To me, none of this is new, and I'm 50 years old. Well, this is an interesting point. In fact, we were talking in our production meeting this morning about how historically in the U.S., a very high percentage of slang comes from African-American culture. New terms are popularized there. Words that are considered hip, often used by African-American artists or musicians, sort of gradually make their way into the mainstream. And of course, by the time the mainstream is using those terms, those hip artists and musicians like African-Americans have moved on to a whole new generation of slang terms by that point. And James Callahan, I'm just wondering, do you have a sense of how many of these words originate among black youth?
I'm not really sure. I know what you mean. I do agree that a lot of these have grown out of African-American and black culture, but I'm not sure of the ones that are on my list, you know, I don't have a sense of how many of them or what particular number of them did grow out of that culture.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you've also got, as we just heard from Joanna, tech culture also, where social media culture contributing as well. Let's take another listener call. This is from John in Pasadena. I understand you're a school counselor.
I'm actually a counselor in private practice.
Oh, okay.
I work a lot with teenagers, and I like the, you know, your other your guest here and your other caller. I love looking up new slang when I hear a client use that use that language. And a couple ones recently. One is the term "ship." It's been around for a little while, but it's another one that comes out of more tech culture or internet culture, especially kids that are on, you know, things like Tumblr or Reddit a lot. It's like, I ship this person together. I've had a client say, "Oh yeah, you know, my friends are shipping me with this other guy," and I'm like, "Whoa, what does that mean?" Like, "Oh, they want to see us get together. They want to see us hook up. They want to see us, you know, they think we'd be good in a relationship, so they ship us together."
Ah, okay.
One that I get a kick out of is, and what I looked up, it's actually quite old slang that's coming back around. It's feeling her oats or feeling his.
Oh yeah, that's an oldie.
I know. I hadn't even heard of that one. I mean, I'm in my late 30s, and I had never, that wasn't part of my, you know, vernacular at all.
Yeah.
But apparently it had showed up on some recent shows like RuPaul's Drag Race or what have you. So kids, oh yeah, and, like, she was just walking along, feeling her oats, having a good time, and then suddenly these people were fussing at us or things like that. It's just so funny to me. I looked it up and I found a Golden Girls clip that happened to use that, and I was like, what? How is this coming back around now? And how did I not even know this was a thing? So anyway, it's just, I always get a kick out of it.
That's funny. Hey, John, I appreciate it. Good to talk with you. Thanks for sharing your observation about slang among younger Americans. 866-893-KPCC. So I wonder if that term that was so popular in the 30s, gee, that's swell. If swell is going to make a comeback, or neat, that's really neat. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Diana in Westchester, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So you're a psychologist trainee for a school district. What's a word you hear a lot?
Yes, well, it's funny. I said to a client the other day, just kind of reflection of feeling, I said, "Oh, dear." And she started cracking up and she said, "Oh, Miss H, you're so extra." You're just ridiculous, you know? So extra is like a thing that they say a lot.
How funny. So extra means just too much?
I think so. Yeah, just like, "Oh, you're killing me. This is just, you're extra."
How funny. Diana, thanks. So, "Oh, dear," was what prompted that. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. James Callahan, how many of your teacher peers at Lowell High School share your interest in that? And do you have conversations with them about words they hear?
I've had plenty of conversations with them over the last couple of weeks since this has gotten so widespread. But before that, I don't think it's something that we really chatted about too much. But it's become, you know, since this has come out, we've some people at the school have said that it's a good way to kind of enhance or teach cultural competency, which is kind of a big part of education these days, being able to understand students and, you know, and reach them at their level. So it's actually, in a way, become sort of a functional document that's helped a lot of my colleagues here at the school.
Julie writes on the page, "I love wig snatched. Reminds me of an old British expression. I used to love wigs on the green," meaning a brawl. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Foodness Gracious writes, "I spotted my daughter texting a friend to meet up, and he told her he had some great tea, T-E-A. I literally thought he was bringing iced tea, but I guess it means gossip or drama, or as we heard earlier, the truth." 866-893-KPCC. Anne writes, "The LA Times had a recipe in Saturday's paper that included TLDR in a box. I didn't have a clue what that meant or who they think their intended audience is. I looked it up. It means too long. Didn't read." Oh, brother. 866-893-5722. Let's see. We have Oncarino in Pasadena. Real quickly, Oncarino, what word do you hear?
We hear the word glitch and the word spam and the word default.
Glitch, spam, and default. So what does default mean?
But when you're default, it means that you're just so basic. You might say, oh my gosh, Bob, you're so default on the basketball court.
That's funny. And glitch?
Glitch is something that's where it's like, it sounds negative, but instead it's like, oh, you know, this juice box is glitched. I got the juice out of the side of it. It's taking something in life that is broken or a loophole and exploiting it like you would a glitch on a video game, I think.
Oh, that's great. Hey, Uncarino, thanks so much for sharing those. And thank you, James Callahan of Lowell High School, a teacher of sociology and the compiler of the Gen Z Slang Dictionary online. Thank you for sharing your experience and teaching us some new words today.
And thank you. I just want to let your listeners know, and actually your callers, that I've had the document open and I've been adding the words that they've been suggesting as we're going along. So
great.
When I release volume 2, it'll be updated with their words.
Hey, thanks so much, James. I appreciate it. And thank you for joining us for another Air Talk. Have a terrific afternoon.